the book of Nahum. Like Obadiah, this book was written against a Gentile power, but a different one. This was not against the Edomites, but against Nineveh, which was the capital of Assyria. Now, most of us, when we hear the word Nineveh, we think of the book of Jonah. Because Jonah's famous prophecy was, 40 days and Nineveh shall perish. Jonah went to Nineveh 150 years before Nahum. And the city repented at the preaching of Jonah. And God spared it. Apparently, 150 years before Nahum's time, God intended to destroy Nineveh for their sinfulness at that time. They were very bloody, bloodthirsty people. Whenever they would conquer another country, they would just rip up the women and the children and so forth. And they were just bloodthirsty, cruel people. And this was the Assyrians. And remember, they are the ones who overthrew the northern kingdom of Israel and threatened to overthrow the southern kingdom of Judah. In fact, the Assyrians did destroy most of the cities of Judah, but failed to take the city of Jerusalem. And it was the Assyrians that God sent his angel against in the days of Hezekiah and Isaiah the prophet, when the Assyrians were besieging the city of Jerusalem round about, and God sent an angel and slew whatever it was, 185,000 of them, or however many. And so these were the Assyrians. They were a world power at the time. This was prior to Babylon's ascendancy as the world power. Before Babylon really came up under Nebuchadnezzar, there were two major world powers in this period of time, and that was Egypt and Assyria. And whenever Assyria would threaten Israel or Judah, usually they would be tempted to seek to Egypt for help, because Egypt was a rival power. However, Assyria was greater. Assyria was definitely eating up, swallowing up all the land around it, and just making the land a bloodbath, because they were so... I've just heard of the kind of treatment and read of the kind of treatment they gave to their conquered ones, and it was very cruel and all. Well, for that reason, Jonah didn't even want to go to Nineveh. As we know, he wanted to go the other direction. He had no love for the Ninevites. He didn't want to warn them. He just as soon would have had them perish. And when he heard that God was going to destroy them in 40 days, he thought, good, if I can stall for 40 days, maybe I can take a trip the other direction to Tarshish, you know, catch a ship to Tarshish. That'll take at least 40 days for me, even if I have to get back to Nineveh. But the idea was God was about ready to wipe out Nineveh. However, Jonah, as we know, ended up preaching in Nineveh after all, and the Ninevites repented of the sins. We don't know which king this was, but one of the kings of Nineveh actually commanded all of his people to repent, which they did. And the city was spared for another 150 years. But eventually their sins, of course, grew again, and God was ready to judge them again. And that was when Nahum wrote. Nahum, we don't know anything about his personal life. He's not mentioned anywhere else in the Bible, with the possible exception of Luke 3:25. In Luke 3, we have a genealogy of Jesus' mother Mary. And in the genealogy, in Luke 3:25, there is a reference to a Nahum, whose name is the same as this man's name. Though, of course, there could be many Nahums, and we have no reason to believe that that's the same Nahum, but it could be. And that Nahum is the father of somebody named Amos, also, in that same verse. There were two men, Nahum and his son Amos, but we don't have any reason to believe that Amos is the prophet Amos either. So these names might not be the same person. Nineveh eventually fell to the Babylonians and the Medes. And Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king, became prominent, and he totally wiped out the Assyrians and Nineveh, and that is what this is looking forward to. An interesting thing that this prophecy predicts about the fall of Nineveh, which did come to pass, was there's reference to a river rising. What actually happened was that the Babylonians and the Medes came and besieged the city of Nineveh for 3 years, or 2 years. And then they couldn't break into the city of Nineveh for two whole years, but then the Tigris River had an unseasonable rise and flooded its banks and washed away some of the walls of Nineveh. This river just rose and washed away the walls of Nineveh. And then, of course, the Babylonians were able to go in and take it. So this rise in the river was God's way of letting the Babylonians get in and conquer it after 2 years of besieging the city. There's reference to this rise in the river in two places in Nahum. In Nahum chapter 1 and verse 8, he says, "But with an overrunning flood, he will make an utter end of the place thereof, and darkness shall pursue his enemies." But he will make an end of it with an overrunning flood, or a river overflowing its banks. In chapter 2 and verse 6, It actually says, the gates of the rivers shall be opened and the palace shall be dissolved. So there's reference to the river, which we now know was fulfilled by the rising of the river on that occasion. So this obviously was a true prophet. Now, as far as the fall of Nineveh, it was so complete that when Xenophon passed by it 200 years later, he couldn't even tell what it was. There were mounds there where Nineveh had been, and Nineveh had been one of the greatest cities in the world. But 200 years after its fall, Xenophon went by, and there were mounds there, and he couldn't even identify it. He thought it was perhaps the ruins of some Parthian city. But then even a little later, in 331 B.C., Alexander the Great fought a major battle, the Battle of Arbela, near the ruins of Nineveh, and he didn't even know there had been a city there. Just about 300 years after the fall of Nineveh, he couldn't even tell. Alexander the Great didn't even know there was a city there at one time. And yet this was this great, proud world power at one time. So it's the destruction was complete. The Babylonians and the Medes destroyed Nineveh, and this prophet writing probably about 20 years before the fall of Nineveh predicted. There are three chapters, and they will have many things that are familiar to us in them. Of course, the prophets tended to use similar language to each other in describing destruction, but we'll make comments where it seems fitting. The Burden of Nineveh, the Book of the Vision of Nahum the Elkoshite, meaning he was from the city of Elkosh, probably in the kingdom of Judah. God is jealous, and the Lord revengeth. The Lord revengeth and is furious. The Lord will take vengeance on his adversaries, and he reserveth wrath for his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger and great in power. He will not at all acquit the wicked. The Lord hath his way in the whirlwind and in the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. He rebuketh the sea and maketh it dry, and drieth up all the rivers. Bashan languisheth, Carmel, and the flower of Lebanon languisheth. The mountains quake at him, and the hills melt, and the earth is burned at his presence, yea, the world and all that dwell therein. Who can stand before his indignation? Who can abide in the fierceness of his anger? His fury is poured out like fire, and his rocks are thrown down by him. The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, and he knoweth them that trust in him. But with an overrunning flood he will make an utter end of the place thereof, that is of Nineveh, and darkness shall pursue his enemies. Now, all this rave here is talking about how God is invincible and just. He will not acquit the wicked, he says in verse 3, and the wicked cannot hope to escape his judgment. After all, as he puts it, God is in control over everything. He gives examples. He has his way in the storm, in the whirlwind, and the clouds themselves are the dust of his feet. Well, this is not to be taken literal. We know the clouds are not made of dust, and Nahum knew that too. But he's basically just using figures of speech to say that all these great things, which are greater than man, these great powers of nature, whirlwinds and storms and clouds, these things are mere dust under God's feet. These things are small things to God. He is in full control of all these things. He even rebukes the sea, he says, and makes it dry. He actually did that once when the Jews were leaving Egypt. He parted the Red Sea. So he's basically saying the sea obeys him. He saw that even in Jesus' lifetime, that the wind and the sea obeyed him when he stood up and rebuked them, told them to be still. And the disciples were amazed. And he dries up the rivers, and the mountains quake at him, and the hills melt. All these things are simply saying nothing can stand before God. He can melt the whole world if he wishes to. He rebukes the sea, and it listens, and it dries up. And the winds and all, they obey him. Yet, in spite of all these things, the first six verses showing how destructive God can be, to even to nature if he chooses, yet in verse 7, the Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble. God is powerful, and that should be a cause for fear to those who are against him, for those who are wicked. But to those who are with him, those who trust in him, it says, he knoweth them that trust in him, they should take a refuge in the fact that he is so strong, that nothing can hurt them. If this God can control all the forces of nature and control all the forces of the universe, then to have him on our side, as Paul said in Romans 8, if God be for us, who can be against us? If God is for us, then we have a stronghold. That is a refuge, a safe place in time of trouble. Now in verse 9 it says, what do you imagine against the Lord? He will make an utter end. Affliction shall not rise up the second time. That is to say, when Nineveh falls, it'll be utterly fall, and it won't ever rise again, and it certainly hasn't. For while they be full together as thorns, and while they are drunken as drunkards, they shall be devoured as stubble, fully dry. There is one come out of thee, out of Nineveh, that is, and this one is Sennacherib, who is the king who besieged Jerusalem, the Assyrian king. There is one come out of thee that imagineth evil against the Lord, a wicked counselor. So this is basically pinpointing one of the major offenses that Nineveh was guilty of. That one of their kings, namely Sennacherib, had imagined evil things against the Lord. Now that's referring to the fact that he thought he'd destroy Jerusalem. He came and besieged Jerusalem and was going to destroy the Lord's city. And that seems to be the big offense. And then verses 12 and 13 are actually addressed to Judah, to the people threatened by Sennacherib, as we'll see, especially in verse 13. But verse 12 says, "Thus saith the Lord, though they be quiet, and likewise many," that is, the Assyrians are many coming against Jerusalem, "thus shall they be cut down when he pass through. Though I have afflicted thee, I will afflict thee no more. For now will I break his yoke from off thee, and burst thy bonds in sunder." That is to say, God is predicting through Nahum that he will break the bonds of Assyria off of Jerusalem, off the people of Judah. And he says that though there are many Assyrians, yet I will cut them down, as he did when he sent his angel among them and slew 185,000 of them. God shows that he will deliver his people from the hand of the oppressor. "And the Lord hath given a commandment concerning thee, Nineveh, that no more of thy name be sown. Out of the house of thy gods will I cut off the graven image and the molten image. I will make thy grave, for thou art vile. Behold, upon the mountains, the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace." Very similar to Isaiah 52, that is a similar thing, which says, "How lovely on the mountains are the feet of him that brings good tidings and publishes peace." But the good news in this case, in Isaiah chapter 52, the good news is that our God reigneth. In this case, the good news is that God will judge Nineveh. He says, "O Judah, keep thy solemn feast, perform thy vows. The wicked shall no more pass through thee. He is utterly cut off." A reference to the destruction of the Assyrians. That's the good news that that the men are carrying, that this prophet is carrying. Chapter 2, "He dasheth in pieces," or "he that dasheth in pieces is come up before thy face. Keep the munition, watch the way, make thy loins strong, fortify thy power mightily. For the Lord hath turned away the excellency of Jacob as the excellency of Israel. For the emptiers have emptied them out and marred their vine branches. The shield of his mighty men is made red. The valiant men are in scarlet. The chariots shall be in flaming torches in that day in his preparation, and the fir trees shall be terribly shaken. The chariots shall rage in the streets. They shall jostle one against another in the broad ways. They shall seem like torches. They shall run like the lightnings. He shall recount his worthies. They shall stumble in their walk. They shall make haste to the wall thereof, and the defense shall be prepared." The word defense there, actually in the Hebrew, is mantle, siege engine, something on wheels that was tall that the soldiers would get up in. It's sort of like a staircase on wheels with a shield in front of it that they could roll right up to the walls of the city and the invading army could go right over. That's the word defense there, actually, is the Hebrew word for a siege engine. It says, "The gates of the river shall be open and the palace shall be dissolved." Now, this is obviously a reference to the judgment that will come upon Nineveh, how the river will remove the wall for the invaders to come in. Because those chariots shall rage in the streets. That is to say, the invading army will bring their chariots right into the streets of Nineveh, and the battle will be raging right in the streets with the chariots jostling against each other and all. It's kind of funny how people often will try to take scriptures out of context and try to find things from the 20th century in the Bible. For instance, people sometimes say that Ezekiel saw a UFO because of Ezekiel chapter 1 and the wheel within the wheel that he saw, and the lights and the shining and the glistening and all. Some try to make that a picture of a UFO that Ezekiel saw. In this passage, I've heard people actually try to say that the Bible predicts the freeways and the cars on the freeways, and they quote verse 4, "The chariots shall rage in the streets, they shall jostle one against another in the broad ways," as though this is some kind of a prediction of the invention of the automobile and the freeway. Obviously, that is very typical of a certain kind of Bible interpretation, where people kind of take a verse at random, they don't understand the passage at all, and something kind of strikes them as being relevant to something, and they pass it along. I've seen this actually in tracts that were printed, tracts that quoted scriptures like this one, saying the Bible predicted airplanes, locomotives, cars on the freeway, and helicopters, and all those things. And there's a series of scriptures like this one that are used to try to show all these things. But obviously this is not referring to freeways and automobiles. This is talking about the invasion of Nineveh by the Babylonians and the chariots in the streets warring there. And the reference to the gates of the rivers being opened in verse 6 makes it clear that that's the event that's under consideration. Verse 7 says, "And Huzzah shall be led away captive." Huzzah is actually, is a name for Ishtar, which was the goddess of the Assyrians. So it's a reference to the idol of Ishtar, the goddess of the Assyrians, out of her temple and being carried away by the Babylonians. "Huzzah shall be led away captive. She shall be brought up, and her maids shall lead her, as with the voice of doves, tabering upon their breasts." Probably means that those who wanted to sing in the temple of Ishtar, the women who sang there as a regular, they were on salary there in the temple, that they would go be carried away captive with the idol itself, and they would be singing like doves, that is, mourning doves, that is, and tabering upon their breasts, I assume, has to do with beating their breasts in agony, or in grief. "But Nineveh is of old like a pool of water, yet shall flee away. Stand, stand, shall they cry, but none shall look back. Take ye the spoil of silver, take the spoil of gold, for there is none end of the store and the glory out of all the pleasant furniture. She is empty and void and waste, and the heart meldeth, and the knees smite together. And much pain is in all loins, and the faces of them all gather blackness." The figures of speech mainly speak of the great pain and fear and the plunder of Nineveh by their invaders. Now, in verses 11 and following, through 13, it sort of reflects back on how Assyria was before, like a lion, like a powerful nation, but now what's happened to them? He says, "Where is the dwelling of the lions, and the feeding place of the young lions? Where the lion, even the old lion, walked, and the lion's whelp, and none made them afraid? The lion did tear in pieces enough for his whelps, and strangled for his lionesses, and filled his holes with prey, and his dens with raven," which means plunder. "Behold, I am against thee, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will burn her chariots in the smoke, and the sword shall devour thy young lions, and I will cut off thy prey from the earth, and the voice of thy messengers shall no more be heard." So he says that previously Assyria was like a lion that could just tear any other animal it wanted to. It could go out and they could strike another nation and totally conquer it and bring back its wealth for its cubs and for its wives. Basically, the king of Nineveh is probably in view here. He had a harem and he had his princes and so forth, and he would go out and he'd smite some other nation, bring back the gold and the silver and the plunder from that nation and give it to his wives and his sons. And that's what he said, "You were like a lion, but now these chariots coming and a sword shall devour the young lions," the prince of Assyria, obviously. Now, chapter 3, "Woe unto the bloody city." The term bloody city actually is in other places of scripture also. I think Ezekiel used the term again about Jerusalem. In this case, bloody city is Nineveh. "It is all full of lies and robbery. The prey departeth not. The noise of the noise of the rattling of the wheels." This is still talking about the battle raging in the streets, the chariots, and the prancing of horses and of the jumping. "The horseman lifteth up both the bright sword and the glittering spear. And there is a multitude of slain and a great number of carcasses. And there is none end of their corpses." They stumble upon the corpses. This devastation will be so great in Nineveh that people won't be able to walk without tripping over dead bodies. They are everywhere. "Because of the multitude of thy whoredoms, of the wealthy harlot, the mistress of witchcrafts, that selleth nations through her whoredoms and families through her witchcrafts." So Nineveh is seen as being involved in the occult. And apparently that's one of the reasons why God was wiping them out, because of their whoredoms, which refers to, of course, worship of false gods, and also because of witchcraft, which is occultism, which apparently she spread to other nations as well. She was evangelistic about her occultism. "Behold, I am against thee, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will discover thy skirts upon thy face, and I will show the nations thy nakedness and the kingdoms thy shame. And I will cast abominable filth on thee, and make thee vile, and I will set thee as a gazing stock. And it shall come to pass that all they that look upon thee shall flee from thee, and say, Nineveh is laid waste. Who will bemoan her? Whence shall we seek comforters for thee?" Then he compares Nineveh to another city, which he calls No, the city of No. Actually, this is a reference to Noamon, which was an Egyptian city. We know it as Thebes. The ancient name of it was Noamon, and it later was known as Thebes. But this was the place where the god Ammon was worshipped by the Egyptians, and this city was overthrown by Assyria in 665 B.C. So apparently Nahum is writing after that point, after 665 B.C., though we don't know the exact date of his writing. He's writing about the overthrow of Noamon, or Thebes, as something already accomplished in his day. And he's pointing out that Thebes, which fell to the Assyrians, was was the same as the Assyrians themselves. They're going to fall to a greater power also. It says, art thou better than the populace? No. That was situate among the rivers, that had the waters round about it, whose rampart was the sea, and her wall was from Ethiopia, and Egypt were her strength. And it was infinite. This shows how the term infinite might be used figuratively rather than literally in the scriptures, saying that the strength of Thebes, oh, that seemed invincible even as Nineveh seems invincible today. They had the sea on one side to protect them. They had Egypt and Ethiopia. All the strength of those countries was available to them. Their strength was infinite. Put in lieu of them, different Arab nations nearby. Says, yet was she cut away. She went into captivity. Her young children also were dashed in pieces at the top of all the streets. This is a reference to how the Assyrians treated the people of Thebes, or anyone else that they conquered, for that matter. Whenever the Assyrians conquered people, they dashed their children against the stones and so forth, and just unnecessary cruelty, of course. There's other references to how they disemboweled pregnant women and all. And he says, this happened to Thebes, but guess what? It's going to happen to you next. He says, and they cast lots for her honorable men, and all her great men were bound in chains. Thou also shalt be drunken, thou shalt be hid, thou also shalt strength because of the enemy. It says they cast lots for the honorable men, and the great men were bound in chains. Probably casting lots means that they gambled over slaves. That is, that when Assyria conquered Thebes, the noble and honorable men of that city were made slaves, and the conquering soldiers cast lots to see who would get to keep them as slaves. And so it says the great men were bound in chains. Now he talks in verses 12 through 14 about the uselessness of Assyria's defenses against the attack that's coming. It says, all thy strongholds shall be like fig trees with the first ripe figs. If they be shaken, they shall even fall into the mouth of the eater. Behold, thy people in the midst of thee are women. Now, that doesn't mean that they are literally women, though it could, of course. It could mean that all the men are killed in war and that all that's left in the city are women. But probably what it's saying is that the people in there are weak as women. Against the attacking Babylonians, the Assyrian defense, the armies that would defend it are as weak as women. No offense to women, but that's basically the way they were viewed. They were viewed as too weak to fight in war. Of course, the Jews don't think that way anymore. They now draft women in their army, but in Israel. But in those days, a woman was definitely not fit to fight in a war. And in Jeremiah chapter 49, I believe it is, no, chapter 51, Jeremiah 51:30, there's another reference to how the Babylonians, later, their armies were mocked as being weak like women. And what's being said here is that their defenses, their armies are too weak to withstand what God's going to bring against them, namely the Babylonian forces are coming against them. And even their strongholds, their great towers and defense cities, they're going to be like fig trees. If someone shakes them, the fig falls right off into the mouth of the man who eats them. And so they're going to be easily shaken. Even the armies, the men in them are like women, weak, that is, against their enemies. The gates of thy land shall be set wide open to thine enemies. The fire shall devour thy bars. Draw thee waters for the siege. Fortify thy strongholds. Go into clay and tread the mortar. Make strong the brick kiln. There shall the fire devour thee. The sword shall cut thee off. It shall eat thee up like a cankerworm. Make thyself many as the cankerworm. Make thyself many as the locust. Thou hast multiplied thy merchants above the stars of heaven. The cankerworm spoileth and fleeth away. Thy crowned are as the locusts, and thy captains as the great grasshoppers, which camp in the hedges in the cold day. But when the sun ariseth, they flee away, and their place is not known where they are. Now, this image, especially in verses 15 through 17, is describing the Assyrians like a plague of locusts. He says they're numerous like locusts. Cankerworm, by the way, is just one of the larval stages that locusts go through in their development. So a cankerworm is the same thing as a locust, really. And he says, basically, your nobles and your crown and your captains, they're as multitudinous as locusts. But just like a plague of locusts, they'll disappear suddenly. A plague just comes and goes. Here today, gone tomorrow. And he says, that's what you're going to be like. You've got numerous people like locusts, but you're going to disappear fast like the locusts, too. It says they camp in the hedges on a cold day, but when the sun rises, they flee away, and their place is not known where they are. So apparently shall the Assyrians be. They're numerous, covering the face of the earth like a plague of locusts, but just like a plague of locusts, they'll be gone soon and suddenly. Verse 18, thy shepherds slumber, O king of Assyria. Thy nobles shall dwell in the dust. Thy people is scattered upon the mountains, and no man gathereth them. There is no healing of thy bruise. Thy wound is grievous. All that hear the bruit of thee shall clap their hands over thee. For upon whom hath not thy wickedness passed continually? That is to say, at the very end it says, everyone who hears about their destruction will clap their hands over you. In other words, will show contempt over you and will rejoice at your fall. Because the wickedness of Assyria has passed over everyone. That is, everyone has suffered at the hands of the Assyrians, and therefore everyone will rejoice at the fall of Assyria, which took place, I believe, about 612 BC, something like that. So that's the prophecy against Nineveh. Perhaps not the most interesting part of the whole Bible, but nonetheless, was very encouraging to the Jews of his day to know that this Assyrian power that had threatened and menaced them was going to fall. And sure enough, it did, even as it was predicted, showing again the predictive power of the prophets. Well, let's close there.